takes a minute to kick in. Great. Welcome, everyone. You are on the five legal documents every parent should have teleclass. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Heather Arweda. I am a founder of Mommy Bites with my business partner, Laura. A little bit of background. So as I mentioned, this teleclass, it will be taped, and we will send you a link. So you don't, please don't feel like you have to take notes. Also, a huge, huge thank you to Shannon McNulty, our expert on today's teleclass. She'll tell you a little bit about her background in a minute. And also, I want to tell you, she has a really, really special, awesome deal for all of you, which I will also let her talk about. So without further ado, let's jump into this. I know this is a lot, and it could be really stressful and overwhelming for parents. So, you know, just kind of let it wash over you. And you know, if there's any questions that come up after the teleclass, please feel free to email us. Otherwise, field them to me throughout. I'll try to get to as many as possible. So, Shannon, welcome.
Thank you, Heather. I'm so excited to be here today.
Shannon, before we get into the nitty-gritty, I know we have a lot to get to. Can you just talk a little bit about your background and then a little bit about what you'll offer to our Mommy Bites moms, and then we'll get into the specific legal documents that you, in your opinion, every parent should have?
Sure. I'm an estate planning lawyer. I worked at a big firm for many years, and then several years ago decided to go out on my own because I didn't think a big firm just wasn't a great fit for me. I have an LLM in taxation. I graduated from Georgetown University for law school, and I also have my certified financial planner designation, and that's because I think it's really important in doing estate planning to understand family's entire financial picture, because it's really is sort of like one continuous or one big issue. And estate planning is just part of your overall financial planning.
That's right. And yeah, and it's not just cookie cutter step one, step two, step three. It's as you said, it's really a whole kind of family dynamic process.
Yes, exactly. And I have an estate planning practice, boutique estate planning practice in Manhattan. All we do is estate planning. And I focus particularly on young families and putting a plan in place to protect their kids. And that's, young families is basically parents with children under the age of 18.
Got it. Okay. And Shannon, you're offering our listeners a special deal. Can you talk a little bit about that? And also I'll send people more information in the follow-up email.
Sure. Yeah. So what I offer generally to, you know, when people call me and they want to sit down and talk about their estate planning and go over their particular situation, I do what is called a legal planning session, and they answer a number of questions so that I can understand their financial background and their family situation, whether there are other issues that we need to address, and then I meet with them for an hour to address those issues and talk about the different options that they would have to put a plan in place. This is something normally, if you go on my website, it's $325 to do that, because it's a whole hour of my time, and plus I do preparation beforehand. And I'm offering your listeners this on a complimentary basis, so they wouldn't have to pay for this at all.
So they get exactly what you would normally charge $300+ for, your time and your background, for free.
Exactly, yes.
Ah,
and there's no
nice
obligation.
Yeah, and that's nice.
Yeah, it's a good deal.
It is a good deal.
Yeah, and there's no obligation. If they decide to do an estate plan with me, that's great. If they don't, then that's fine as well.
And I will send people more information on how to go about setting that up. But that's super great and generous. Thank you, Shannon. So let's get right into it, because we have a lot to get to. So it seems like most estate planning focuses on retirees or older people. Why do you focus on young families?
Well, you know, Heather, estate planning is just as important, if not more important, for families with young kids, because children literally depend on their parents for survival, to feed them, to bathe them, clothe them, put a roof over their heads. So if something happens to the parents, the children are entirely helpless. So, you know, you're not just talking about what happens to your assets and who you want to leave your money to. You're talking about who is going to take care of your kids and making sure that they end up in a caring and supportive environment. So it's alarming how many parents don't have a plan in place. So it's really my mission to make sure that all parents think through this issue and put a comprehensive plan in place to protect their family.
Got it. It makes sense. And why is it so important for parents to have a plan in place? It seems kind of far away sometimes, right?
Yeah, none of us want to think that anything can happen to us, but the truth of the matter is that, none of us is immune from misfortune. So, and sometimes we just can't, we can't predict what's going to happen in the future, and sometimes we can't prevent an accident, but what we can do is make sure that if something does happen, that our kids would receive the best care and protection possible. And I think it's important to understand what would happen, so understand how important this is. It's really important to know what would happen to our family if we died without any plan in place. And so I think to understand this and to give you a little bit of a feel for what would happen in this situation, I'm going to tell you a story, because I think stories can be helpful in a way that if I was talking about legal technicalities and jargon, it might not be that helpful. So this is a story about a couple with three kids who were a lot like many parents out there. They had intended to put a will in place for years after the birth of their first child, and three kids later, they didn't have a will. They just were extremely busy, and they just never had gotten around to it. There was just always something more pressing that needed their attention, and I think we all can relate to that. Unfortunately, one summer, the family was on vacation, and they were in a terrible car accident. Both parents died on impact, and the three children survived. Because there was no plan in place, there was a lengthy and expensive legal battle among the relatives over who would take custody of the children, because one of the relatives of the father had wanted to take custody, and a family member on the mother's side wanted to take custody, and they couldn't agree, so they took it to court. In the meantime, there was no guardian for the children, and the court ordered the children into foster care while the issue of guardianship was resolved. Eventually, one of the children's aunts was awarded custody, and the children were ordered into her care. But I think, looking at that story, you can see that not having a will that designates a guardian for your kids can have enormous consequences. A child who has just experienced one of the greatest traumas that we can imagine, the loss of both their parents, is then sent to stay in the home of a complete stranger. And that doesn't happen all the time, but it is a possibility. And I wish that the story that I told you was simply a made-up story, but it was actually a true story. It happened to parents named Melanie and Casey Barber. And just like so many parents, they put off doing their will for many years and with devastating consequences for their kids. So designating a guardian is really an absolute must for any parent. And there are other issues as well beyond naming the guardian. It's important to understand what would happen to your assets that are left to your children. So you have the issue of who would take care of your child on a daily basis, and then you have the other issue of what would happen to your children's inheritance and the assets you leave to them. So your assets would be divided equally among your children, but because children under the age of 18 are not legally capable of managing assets, the assets that are left to them are held in what we would call a court-supervised guardianship. This type of guardianship is different from the guardianship of your kids. It's the guardian of the assets, and the court appoints a guardian of these assets to administer them for the benefit of the children. This guardian can be the same as the guardian taking care of your kids, or it can be someone else. And the guardian of the assets files annual reports with the court about how the money is being spent.
So, it's sad and interesting to hear you talk about this, because it's something my husband and I put off and then finally sat down a few years ago to do this. And it's the reason why I think, at least the reason why we put it off, is because it's not like a feel good. It's not a fun thing to think about. And it also can be stressful on a relationship because sometimes the husband and wife don't necessarily agree on who the guardian should be. So that brings up all sorts of stuff too. But especially hearing this story, what it brings up is that it's really, really super important, and all the negative consequences that you just described are avoidable. And
absolutely.
So, right? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. It's all avoidable. And it's just, you know, it's important stuff. And sometimes when it's not fun stuff to talk about, we just decide, oh, we're not going to talk about it. But this is really, really important stuff. Shannon, can you talk a little more about kind of what happens with the court supervising children's inheritances? Like, what are some other things people should think about?
So there are a number of problems with this arrangement. The first is a matter of privacy. So the guardian of the assets files annual reports with the court, and these reports are a matter of public record. So what's in these reports? The reports detail how much money is being held for your child, in what assets or institutions the money is invested, and what the money is being spent on. So how much money is detailed, how much money is being paid for the child's nanny or their private school, their field trips, their clothing, and so on. So things that none of us would want in the public record for ourselves, and never mind our children. So privacy is a really big issue. The second problem arises where you have more than one child. So if you have more than one child, the assets are divided equally among them, and the share that's allocated to each child can only be used for the benefit of that child. So you might think, well, that sounds reasonable, that's fair, that everything is divided equally and is used equally. In a lot of cases, that is fair and there is no problem with it. But a problem can arise where, suppose your child is in an accident and has high medical or therapeutic expenses, then one child has a much greater need than the other children. So, for example, in the case of the Barbers, maybe one of the children had gone injured in the accident and they had very high expenses to address those injuries. And, you know, I think as parents we would say, well, we would adjust our spending and allocate more to one child that has a greater need than to the other children. But in a court-supervised guardianship, the guardian cannot do that. Legally, they can only use the money for the child who it's left to and it's allocated to, and that could create a lot of unfairness. So that's another problem. The third problem is that your kids would have complete and unrestricted access to their inheritance on their 18th birthday. And I don't know about you, Heather, but if I had a big chunk of money I was going to entrust to somebody, it probably wouldn't be an 18-year-old. So early access,
right?
Yeah. So, I mean, early access to this kind of money, it can result not only in the money being squandered, that's one problem, but also it can result in the development of bad spending habits or poor work ethic. And we don't want our kids to grow up thinking, well, you know, I don't have to work, and then you could have long-term consequences. So I think a lot of parents don't understand sort of these potentially devastating consequences of not planning, which often is why, you know, like you were saying, a lot of people don't have a plan in place.
That's right. It's right. And by the way, I see more questions coming in. I will, I'll let Shannon get through a few more talking points, and then I'll pause and I'll take some of these questions that have been typed in. So Shannon, so what documents do you think our listeners need to put in place to make sure some of these terrible things don't happen? I mean, there's a lot of kind of simple wills that people can fill out online. Is that sufficient, or, you know, what do you think is next step?
A lot of people say, oh, I just need a simple will. Even, you know, people who I work with, they come in and they say, oh, I just need a simple will. But I think what they don't understand is what that means. So a simple will is great in the sense that it designates a guardian for your children. So that, I think, is of primary importance. So that issue is addressed with a simple will. But all of these issues that I talked about with respect to the court supervision of the kid's inheritance, none of those issues are addressed by a simple will. It's exactly the same as if you had no will. The assets are going to be left directly to the children, and because they can't, if they're under the age of 18, they can't manage those assets. So all of the privacy issues, the issues of the flexibility in making the distributions for each child, and the early access to their inheritance, none of those issues can be addressed with a simple will.
And so, you know what, Shannon, can I just jump in for 1 second? Because someone just typed this in, and this is relevant to what you're saying right now. So this person wants to know what the average cost you should pay to get a will is, and also average cost of a trust. So I know you're going through, but just if we can address that as well.
Sure. It depends. I think, like, on a lot of things, it depends on if you're getting sort of the cheapest thing out there, you're getting the most expensive. I can't even tell you how much it ranges. But, you know, for my services, it's a little over $2,000 to do the complete plan with your trust as well. For a simple will, it's about $1,500. So just to give you a feel for about what it would cost.
The average. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there are definitely firms that charge far more than that, many times that. And then there are firms that I wouldn't say you can go to a law firm and get it for a whole lot cheaper than that. But if you go to a lawyer who doesn't do much in the way of estate planning, they don't really do this work, but they will say, oh, I can do a will and a trust for you. You might be able to get it cheaper. But again, this is somebody who doesn't have expertise in this area, so it would be like me, you know, negotiating a plea for a prisoner. I would never do that. So,
right.
So you want to look at not only, okay, having it done by a lawyer, but also having it done by a lawyer who has a background in this area.
Okay. And a follow-up question, and then I know you want to talk about trust. Someone just typed in, once created, how often should it be updated or revised? I have a 5-year-old and a newborn. That's a great question, actually. I haven't even thought about updating mine in a long time. It's a phenomenal question.
Yeah, I get that question a lot. And the great thing is that in a lot of cases, once you do this planning, if you have it done really well and it's high-quality plan, you don't actually have to update your documents. Very rarely, and you have to update them. Sometimes you can go your whole life and have the same estate plan. So it really is a very long-term investment. So what I see the most is people have to make minor changes. So they'll say, oh, you know, I put my guardian, my mom is my guardian, but 10 years later, 5 years later, she's not doing as well. So she's getting older and maybe she wouldn't be able to handle it. So we would then change it to a sibling or somebody who was younger. So those are the sort of the most common changes I see are just small changes with respect to who you're naming as guardian or for other roles. The other times where you would want to change, if you're getting separated from your spouse or you're getting divorced, then you absolutely should have everything redone. So that's a time when you definitely want to take a look at everything again. And then a lot of times I get a question, if you move to another state, are your documents effective? Do you have to have it all redone? And the answer to it generally is no. Your documents, if they're legally executed in the state where you had them done, then they would be effective in other states. There's a little bit of a caveat. You might want to go to a lawyer and make sure in your new state to make sure there's nothing that they need to do. And especially and these are some of the other issues I'm going to talk about, but your power of attorney and your healthcare proxy, those are forms often that are state specific. So if you're in a new state, those are forms that you might want to have redone.
Got it. Okay, that's super helpful. I'm just going to field you this next question because you just touched on changing marital status and how that can affect updating wills. So this is a specific example, but I think we can take it also as a general how life circumstances change and what you should do. So this person says, thanks for your seminar. You're welcome. I have been living with my partner for 8 years and we have one child. Is there a financial benefit to either, one, getting married, two, getting a document in New York for domestic partnership? Thanks for letting me know.
I believe that a domestic partnership has the same effects as of being married. And if the child is the partner that you're living with, then they would have the same parental rights as if you were married. I think that when you're not married, there's more reason to get these documents done because the default rules are different if you're married and if you're not married. So for example, for a healthcare proxy, which is a document where the person who's named in the healthcare proxy can make medical decisions for you if you're incapacitated. If you don't have that in place, then it will default to your spouse. But if you're not married, then it's not defaulted to that person. So, you know, it could be defaulted to another relative who, maybe wouldn't want to make those decisions for you. So there are issues, and as well in terms of inheritance, who would end up with your assets? Would it be your spouse? Would it be your children? So there are sort of other issues that come into play when there is some, when you're not married. Does that mean you should get married? Not necessarily if you don't want to get married, but I think it does, I think it's in that situation.
Something to think about.
It's even more important to have your documents in place and to understand, like, what would be the plan and what would happen if something happened to either of you.
Right, right.
There can be some tax benefits for estate planning, estate tax purposes, but that really depends on your financial situation. So if you don't have to worry about the estate taxes, then that's not an issue.
Got it. Okay. So actually, let's circle back then, because this is now we've touched on it and it's come up in a few questions. So let's talk about the role. We talked a little bit about a will. Let's talk about the role of a trust. I think, and also, is it necessary if you have minor children? Because I think a lot of people think of the word trust and you think that, you have to be uber wealthy, like the Kennedys, the Rockefellers, and that's not something most people need. But, is it? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think if you have children who are under the age of 18 and you would be leaving them any significant amount of assets, you absolutely should have a trust. And I think there is a common misperception that this is only for really wealthy people. And I think that's in part because there are so many different types of trusts, and a lot of times they're used for tax reasons. And often that's part of why they have them in these very wealthy families. But there are also a whole lot of other reasons why you would have a trust, and primarily being, in our cases, if you have kids who are under the age of 18 and you don't want their inheritance to end up in this court-supervised process. So a trust addresses all of those issues. It's basically a legal vehicle that your assets would be transferred to upon your death, and you would name a trustee who would supervise the assets and administer the trust for the benefit of your kids. It's completely private, so you would have no public reporting on what assets are in the trust, how those distributions are being made, what they're being made for. The trustee could make distributions to any of your children depending in response to their needs, so they could adjust those distributions if one child had a greater need. And you would be able to name in the trust document or specify an age at which the children would receive their inheritance. So you can name, say 25, 30, 35, some parents say 40. So that's another benefit of the trust as well. But I think that if you do have kids under the age of 18 and you would be leaving them anything of significance, then you should have a trust in place.
Got it. Okay. We've had some other questions typed in, but I have a feeling that those will be answered in this next section. So if you typed in a question in the past few minutes, I think it will be answered. All right. So we need a will and a trust. Are there any other documents that are important to have?
Yes. So a will and a trust are the primary documents to make sure your family is protected in the event that you pass away. But there are other issues. There's another circumstance, another possibility that could present problems to your family, and that's the case where you're incapacitated. Suppose you get into an accident and you're in the hospital and you're unconscious. There are a whole host of problems that can arise in that scenario. And there are three documents that are important in that case. So the first document is what we would call a standby guardianship designation. This document designates a guardian for your children in the event that you're incapacitated and you're not able to, generally when you're unconscious. The guardianship designation in your will, it's not effective unless you pass away, so a standby guardianship designation fills this gap. It allows the designated person to have legal custody of your children between, if you're incapacitated, and also between the time, if you did pass away and the time the court officially appoints a guardian in your will. So there is a, it fills that gap there. So there's no time in which your children don't have a guardian. The second document is a power of attorney. And this document allows you to authorize someone to manage your finances. So every month we make payments to, you know, the mortgage company, to our kids' school, daycare, nanny, to make sure that our family is taken care of. And if all of a sudden we're in the hospital and we don't know what's going on, who is going to make those payments and what's going to happen if those payments aren't made, it could be really disruptive to your family at a time that's already very difficult. So by having a power of attorney in place, that allows someone to step in who you trust to make those payments and manage your finances. So that's a really important document to have. And then the third document, and this is something that I mentioned earlier, was the healthcare proxy. And that is a document that authorizes someone to make medical decisions for you in the event that you're unable to make those decisions yourself. And that could be really helpful for your family at a difficult time. And also, I just want to mention quickly that for a standby guardianship designation, not all states have that. In New York, we do. But, for example, in New Jersey, that's included in your power of attorney. So in some states, that it's not a separate document.
Okay, got it. So I know we're going to switch gears and we're going to talk about estate taxes. Before we do, there's been a theme that's come in with questions, so I'm going to consolidate about three or four questions that have come in.
Sure.
So basically, a lot of people want to know if there's a good source to get sample versions of these five legal documents. And then, so if we could touch on that. And then also, if you could go back and just in like one sentence, talk about the main difference between a trust and a will. I know you touched on that, but I know we kind of got sidetracked because of me.
Sure. So there are a lot of online resources where you can get sample documents for these types of documents examples. In some of them they're more straightforward. Your healthcare proxy and your power of attorney, they differ from state to state, so you want to make sure you're getting the one for your state. And then there's also, a will is a fairly simple document, but how it's executed is not. So you need an affidavit, an acknowledgement, two witnesses, a notary. So those are things where I feel like the online resources are not so great. Heather, it's just like anything else when you're investing in something to protect your kids. If, do you want to get the cheapest thing out there? And, for example, when you buy a car seat for your child, you go out and say, okay, I'm just going to buy the cheapest car seat that I can find. Well, probably not, right? You're going to look at what is the quality of those and what's going to provide the best protection for your child. And, so I definitely think that it's better to have a lawyer to help you, preferably a lawyer who specializes in these issues. But for some parents actually have to buy the cheapest car seat. They don't have a choice. They're trying to just be able to put a roof over the kids' heads and feed them. And in that case, I think, an online resource can be really helpful, like LegalZoom, or there are other ones out there. The scenario is either you don't have these documents at all or you have something that you get online, then I definitely think, it's better to do something online.
Yeah, makes sense. It makes sense. And back to your car seat example, you're sitting down as a family and you're figuring out the best quality of whether it's legal advice or a car seat or a will that your family can afford, that's kind of the theme. And what I hear you saying is something is better than nothing. If that's your budget, that's great. Something better than nothing.
Exactly. And there's so many different situations that people have, their financial situations, what assets they're invested in. And because of our time constraints today, I can't get into everything. You definitely, when I sit down with clients, I give them a number of options. I say, this would be, your basic plan. This is a more comprehensive plan. This is sort of, above and beyond. And then they can make that decision for themselves.
Right. It's not, unfortunately, this is not one of those sort of cookie cutter cases or answers. It's each family has different unique needs.
Especially when it comes to the trust. That's just not something. There's a lot of legal technicalities under trust, and it's just not really something you want to do on your own.
Exactly. In fact, okay. So in one or two sentences, the main difference between a will and a trust.
So a will designates your guardian, and it directs who your assets go to, but it cannot. Your will generally, in a simple will, it just says it goes to your children or it goes to somebody in particular. You can't specify the terms in which the assets are held or when they receive it. What we usually often do is there's a couple different types of trust, but I'll just give you an example of the most common one is a testamentary trust. And that actually is made part of your will. So often we'll do the will and the trust together, and the will says, I'm leaving everything to this trust under these particular terms. It's going to be held in a common trust for all of my children until they reach age, 30 or whatever. And then you would name the trustee who would supervise it. So there's sort of a will is sort of, there are different types of wills, but you could have a will that incorporates a trust in it, if that makes sense.
Okay. And again, some of these nuances, if people have follow-up questions, feel free to email them, or it's something that I'm sure Anna could go over during her complimentary one-on-one session. These are great questions, everyone, so thank you. And for the caller that just typed in, if we could repeat some of the five documents, so just for the sake of time, to that caller, we're actually sending everyone a link to this taped class, so if people had to call in late, don't worry, you'll get all of this. You can listen to it at your convenience. Okay, let's move on to estate taxes. Who needs to worry about leaving their family with a big estate tax bill? So what does that mean, estate taxes? Who should be worried, and what should we do about it?
So you definitely want to look and to see and think about whether this is something that would affect your family, because it can take a big chunk out of what you're leaving for your family and to your kids' inheritance. So there are two different types of estate taxes. There's estate taxes on the federal level, and there's estate taxes on the state level, depending on what state you live in. Estate taxes generally are subject to what we would call an exemption amount. And at the federal level, this amount is approximately $5.5 million. And what that means is that for any individual, if your assets, if your estate is less than $5.5 million, then you don't have to worry about estate taxes at all. You're not going to have to pay estate taxes. Where often some people might think, well, I have, $4 million or $3 million in my total net worth. And then you want to think of your total net worth, like what is your house, is everything that you own. But also your life insurance proceeds are included in the value of your estate. So even if you have a $4 million net worth of assets and you have a $2 million life insurance policy, then you're going to have a taxable estate because the value of your total estate is going to be $6 million, and that $500,000 is going to be subject to estate tax, the amount that exceeds the $5.5 million. And the estate tax, the federal estate tax rate is 40%. So anything over the $5.5 million is going to be taxed at 40%. For the state level in New York State, it's changing every year, actually. The exemption amount is increasing. Right now it's a little over $4 million, and a couple of years that will be tied to the federal exemption. But if you live in Connecticut, if you live in New Jersey, the estate tax exemptions are far, far lower. So in New Jersey, it's I think it's $675,000. In Connecticut, I think it's $1 or $2 million. So we really have to look at each state. And because the federal exemption is quite high right now, a lot of times the estate tax is far more burdensome on families. So it is something that you want to look at.
Got it. Okay. And I'll just say to our listeners, so I know when Shannon mentioned, you know, a net worth of $5 million, that's obviously, that's a huge amount of money, and probably very few people in America have that. But more to the point is what Shannon's saying is, depending on where you live in each state, that number varies. So, you know, we're trying to give a general overview right now of different things for people to think about. So, Shannon, what are some of the most challenging obstacles for parents when putting all of this into place? Like, you work primarily with families. So what comes up? What are people's hot buttons?
Sure. I think what you were saying, and you know, in the beginning of our call about, it's something you don't really want to think about, right? It's kind of scary. It can put pressure on a relationship. And you don't want to think that, well, gosh, you know, you might not be here at some point, and especially that somebody else would have to take care of your kids. But, you know, like I mentioned, it's just something that we all have to face. You know, none of us are immortal, and we just want to make sure that there is a plan in place that your kids would get the best possible care if something did happen. Choosing a guardian, like you said, it's another big issue. It can be really hard for parents to make that decision, whether they just generally collectively are having a hard time, or sometimes, a lot of times, you know, the mom wants her mom or her sibling to be the guardian, and the father wants somebody from his family. And so that's, the guardianship is another obstacle. And then I think also is just time. You know, we only have so much time in the day, and this is something that's not, you don't ever think of it as pressing. And you just keep putting it off. And I think that's the example of actually what did happen to the Barber family. There was evidence that they had talked about this many times, and I believe it was actually the guardianship that held it up for them. But you just don't ever want to be, you know, have a situation where you just put it off and, well, it was just too late, because you just never know something is going to happen.
Right. And then how do you help clients overcome some of these obstacles?
Well, because estate planning is kind of a scary thing, my firm's branding is really the opposite. It's like very soothing, very upbeat. We really try to focus on, okay, what is the long-term goal? Taking care of your kids and having this behind you and having that peace of mind. Like, how are you going to feel after this is all done when you know that, you know, things will be taken care of no matter what happens, and you can kind of put this in a drawer and not have to look at it for a little while. And knowing that, you know, they could always call me if something came up. And so I think just, you know, trying to have a different approach to it rather than sort of the traditional stuffy law firm, where it can be really intimidating. And the other thing is, you know, for choosing a guardian, I think the important thing is just make sure you choose somebody. Even if, you know, if you narrowed it down to two people, there's probably, you know, your kids are probably going to be fine with either person. So even if you have to flip a coin and make that decision, put it down, you know, put something in writing and get it done, you can always change it later. So I think the important thing is it's much better. Sure, sorry.
I was just going to just jump in. So I have this question, and actually someone just typed in this question. Can mm-hmm. each partner pick a different guardian in a legal document? When you just said flip a coin and, you know, you can have two, you're saying you have to have one. You have to agree on one, or can you have two different?
Technically, you
tricky, right?
Can have two. Yeah, I mean, I don't really ever encourage that. You know, the fact of the matter is that it's going to be whoever dies last is going to be the person whose guardian, ends up. Because the kids would go to the
parents,
spouse.
The living
yeah,
parent.
Yeah, there's no guardian
right, yeah.
when there's a living parent. And then yeah. if they passed away, then it would be whoever they designated, generally. I really think it's best if you can to pick the same person.
Yeah, got it. Okay. And kind of along, I know we're talking about the theme of obstacles. So we had a listener type in a question about if her child has specific medical conditions and how that all plays in with it. And I think just for the sake of time, I'll invite that caller to maybe reach out to you directly because that may be a little bit more of a specific case. So to that caller, I'll make sure and give you Shannon's contact information and you can reach out to her directly.
Yeah, and I'll just say, I mean, there are a lot of parents who have, you know, a child who has special needs. And what I would say, it's not necessarily all that much different in terms of the planning, but it's even more important that you put something in place because obviously that child, they might rely on you for a much longer time than even 18 years.
Right, right. So before we move on to some mistakes that you found, biggest mistakes, anything else with helping clients overcome obstacles that you have found useful?
I think the other thing is to just try to make it really easy for them. So we utilize a lot of technology so people can, you know, fill out things online and they can do conference calls from their home or office if they need to. And we also, you know, if it's necessary, we'll meet clients after hours. So really trying to make it easy for them so that they can put something in place without it being too disruptive is really one of the goals that we have for my firm.
And Shannon, before we move on to some like lessons learned from parents, I'm going to read you this question. I think it's a really good one. Is it a good idea to have a different person to manage the trust, the financial portion of your estate, different from the guardian in an effort to balance the management of the finances? What's your recommendation? That's a great question.
Yeah, I think it is a great question. And generally, I recommend that it is somebody else. And it doesn't have to be. Sometimes somebody says, oh, well, I just want it, this one person. There's nobody else who I want to be involved. So I do think it's good to have somebody else, partially because of accountability, and then partially it balances the burden as well. You know, the person who's taking care of your kids, well, then they don't have to be worrying about the finances as well. The only thing I would caution about is that you probably don't want it to be somebody who doesn't get along. So you don't want two people who don't get along. That often doesn't work out so well. But if you have two people who get along, I think it's a good idea to have different people.
Got it. Okay. Great, great questions, everyone. Let's pause for a moment before we move on to common mistakes, lessons learned. And I just want to remind people we are taping this. I will send you the link. In the follow-up link, I will have Shannon's contact information, her website, her checklist, and then I'll have details on how people can access Shannon's special offer for the complimentary consultation. Shannon, is there, someone wants to know, is there a code, a special code, or we'll just explain to people in the follow-up email, I assume, right?
Yeah, there is a code, and
okay.
You'll be sent it on an email.
Okay, got it, okay. And also, I think I mentioned this, and obviously Shannon's contact information. So let's move on. I know we have about a few minutes left, but I want to try to get to as much as possible. Okay, so what are some of the biggest mistakes that parents make when estate planning?
I would say, and we covered this, not having a plan in place, not having a trust in place. The other thing that I see is, not utilizing a lawyer. There's a lot of mistakes that could be made online. And then the other thing that I do feel like is a big issue is not coordinating your beneficiary designations for your life insurance and your retirement accounts with your overall estate plan. So when we're doing estate planning, it's not just about legal documents. It's about your overall plan of making sure that things would be taken care of, everybody would be protected in the case that something did happen. So your beneficiary designations for your life insurance and your retirement accounts, that's often a huge part of our estates. And if they're not coordinated so that they go with our estate plan, then it's like we're missing half the picture.
Got it. Okay. And then outside of the legal documents that you've gone over, are there other things that parents can do to make sure their children are taken care of?
Yeah. So, you know, when I work with clients, we do all of their legal documents, but there are other things that are not part of the legal process. One thing that I recommend is writing a letter to your guardian or guidelines for your guardian. And this would include all the information that you would leave, for example, for a babysitter, indication as notes about where important documents can be found, for example, birth certificates or social security cards. And then also some other issues such as how do you want them raised, what values, and if there are any traditions, family traditions, religious traditions that you want them to be raised with, then that's something that you can put in a letter to your guardian to kind of help them out and give them some guidance. A letter to the trustee, I think, is also important that would tell them, it gives them some guidance on how you would want the money to be distributed and used. You know, it's important to keep money for their education or traveling abroad. You want them to be able to travel abroad. Those types of things can be helpful for the trustee. We generally don't recommend putting them in the trust itself because you want that trustee to have a lot of flexibility, but you can put them in sort of a separate non-legally binding document to give the trustee some guidelines. You would want to put together an inventory of your assets so that if something happened, somebody knew, well, what are all of those assets that are out there? Any life insurance policies, annuities, bank accounts, brokerage accounts, and also anything of value that you might have in your house that maybe somebody else doesn't even know that it would be valuable and it could end up getting thrown out. Like, I don't know, if you had like a valuable stamp collection or something, you want to make sure that those are preserved. And then finally, a list of your digital assets and your passwords. So, for example, our Facebook accounts, or if you have some kind of service where you keep your family photos, those things, you can't access those without the login information. And even if you have often a power of attorney, or if you're the executor of an estate, for example, Facebook won't allow you to access somebody's account even after they've passed away. So it's really important to make sure that login information is available. And sometimes these days we can have very valuable things online, like if you have an online business and you need the login information for that, if nobody can get into it, it could all of a sudden be completely worthless. So those are some other things that we want to talk about. And that's why I really say, you know, it's not just about the documents. It's about really looking at your overall situation and making sure everything is taken care of.
Got it. Okay. We have time for one more question that's come in, and it has to do with preparing for an initial meeting with someone like yourself. But before I get to that, I want to pause for a moment. Can you talk a little bit about your website, Savvy Parents, and how you set that up and how people can access that? Because it's a really cool concept.
It's savvy-parents.com. It's a relatively new website. I'm really excited about it. And it's a resource where people can go and get free information on, we have all kinds of articles about estate planning, about financial planning, and also about other legal issues such as parental leave and your rights as an employee. So I think it's a great resource. We're also starting to have webinars once a month where we address a different topic where, you know, it's similar to this, but we go into much more depth about a particular topic. And we have an online newsletter. So if you're interested in these topics that we're talking about today, I would definitely check it out and sign up.
That is awesome. That is such a good idea. And I will make sure and send everyone the link to it. But it's savvy-parents.com. And in the follow-up, Shannon and I will find some links to some articles that are up there and maybe some stuff that we've gone over or maybe some stuff that we didn't have time to get to. That's really super valuable.
It's a way to reach parents who don't take advantage of my legal services or are not in New York. So I think it can be really helpful for a lot of people.
Exactly. So, okay. One last final question. And then unfortunately we will be at the end of our time together, but if people want to take advantage of your consultation, what information should I have on hand to present at the initial consultation?
Okay, so when you schedule the consultation, you'll get a questionnaire online that you would fill out that would give me the information that I need to prepare. And really that's so you'll know going in what I need, and I will have that information before we meet. So then when we do meet, I'll be able to address your particular circumstances.
Got it. Okay. Awesome. This has been so great. I want to thank everyone. I want to thank Sandy McNulty. You have been awesome, incredibly generous with your time and also with your follow-up offer to our parents. It's incredibly generous. And also just really nice to have a separate website dedicated to parents, Savvy Parents, savvy-parents.com. I want to thank all our listeners. I want to thank everyone that submitted questions. They were phenomenal and great, and this has been outstanding, Shannon. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Heather. It's been great.